Welcome to the new and engaging content from the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion team from ILTSA's DEI Task Force, soon to be a committee. This is season one, and over the next year, our committee and parts of our task force will be taking a look at ILTSA's in innovative and new places in DEI. This is one of our first ones for season one, and I would like to welcome two of our guests, including my amazing co-host, Karina Wills, and our guest for today, Alexis Robertson. Ladies, would you introduce yourselves, please?
Sure, Beth Ann. My name is Karina. I am currently serving as the chair of the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Task Force for ILTSA, and I'm also a senior project manager at Foley and Lardner.
Thanks so much for having me today. My name is Alexis Robertson. I'm director of diversity and inclusion, also at Foley and Lardner, and delighted that both you and Karina reached out to have me on. This is one of my favorite topics, right? It has to be.
Well, it's really important right now, especially within legal, but especially more than anything else, in this kind of era of this global pandemic, there's a lot of conversations about how we're working together, and DEI has to play a part of that. So let's dive in. You're both at the same organization. What types of innovation do you see happening there? And what type of initiatives are going on that we should know about?
Well, I'll jump in and I'll give a little bit of background as well. So like I said, at Foley, I'm the firm's director of diversity and inclusion, and I'm generally focused on the legal talent at the firm. So I sit within the legal talent department. So a lot of the things that I talk about are almost exclusively focused on our lawyers or our timekeepers. And I think maybe during this conversation, we could talk a little bit about the legal industry and how there is still a distinction between timekeepers and non-timekeepers and who's included and what sorts of initiatives. But in terms of my focus at the firm, even before I jump into anything specific, a lot of what I'm doing is changing people's mindsets and frames of reference. And so I don't view, and I think it's a great question, but just to even show you what I mean, I don't view DEI as a specific initiative or a specific program, right? It has to be incredibly comprehensive. And for me, when I'm looking at the attorney talent, it needs to be embedded in every aspect of our people systems across the board. And so I frequently am talking, whether it be externally or inside of the firm, and reminding people that diversity and inclusion, you don't even need the word diversity, equity, and inclusion. You don't need those words. You can just talk about people. So my job is to make sure that we are resonating with all kinds of people and that no matter what type of person you are, what particular things make you you, that you feel like you have an equal opportunity to thrive within our environment. So one thing we've been doing just more broadly within legal talent development is taking a hard look at all of the systems, particularly at the major inflection points from recruiting all the way up to the promotion to partner, but frankly, all the way to retirement, and looking at those to say, what can we do to make these more fair, to make them more intentional, to make them more equitable? So while I'm definitely doing the typical things you think of, I'm definitely doing the supporting the affinity groups, the looking at what sorts of training we could do, what kind of external sponsorships. A huge part of what I'm doing is also talking with the other aspects of my legal talent team, as well as the firm, to look at systems in particular, because I'm, for anyone who follows me on LinkedIn, if you don't, please find me. You'll soon learn that I'm very passionate about systems work as it relates to diversity and inclusion. I think for too long, we've made DEI this individual changing hearts and minds mandate, and or attempted mandate, should I say, and that's, there's a place for that. That work needs to continue, but there's things we can do as organizations to change our systems to make it more equitable and easier for everyone. So I will stop there because I could rant for the next 20 minutes about that. But so we're doing a lot of system stuff at Foley, I think would be the short answer to your question.
That's a really interesting perspective. I'm wondering, you know, your focus on systems work, is that something that you're seeing as a trend across the industry? And or are there other trends out there happening in like the diversity, equity, inclusion space that you think are exciting?
I like to think it is the next wave of DEI. So I'll sometimes call it DEI 3.0 because, you know, and there, D&I 1.0 or it was just the D, it was diversity. And it was, let's get different sorts of people in our organization. And then 2.0 was, oh my gosh, this is about inclusion. Just because you bring people in doesn't mean that you're going to be able to unlock their potential. Now, I think, and I labeled 3.0 as that much more comprehensive, including systems. It's not just me, you know, bringing Karina and Beth in to give you a single inclusive inclusion of the workplace or implicit bias training, but it's also me looking at what is the review system? Like, what are we doing to ensure there is equitable feedback? How are we supporting people in that? And doing things such that ideally our structure is such that even if I don't have individual buy-in from you, the results are largely going to be fair, for everyone. So I do think more organizations are talking about that. I think more law firms are doing that. You can see that even within the structures of where they'll put diversity within the organization. But I still think it's something that is on the vanguard and that I'm in many ways speaking into existence, because I simply don't see how we can reach the goals we have for diversity without changing all these people facing things that we know either, you know, and it's not at all intentional, but that we know could help better neutralize bias, and that currently is structured, they don't.
You know, when you're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, a lot of people focus on bringing in diverse talent and recruiting diverse talent and not necessarily retaining diverse talent. And what you're focused on, I think, is more on that back end, retaining. So making systems fair, as you said, are there other pieces that you think would improve like a firm's retention of diverse talent and grow them?
And just to orient listeners even more, so with diversity and inclusion, ultimately it's all the things, right? Because the things that make it difficult for underrepresented groups to thrive, so it's death by a thousand cuts, right? It's not just, oh, we just need to address this one. We have an affinity group for that. You feel supported. Now you're going to work here. No, it's the process in which they were interviewed. It's the schools you looked at. It's the questions you asked. And you do, I think, a lot of times, and this is me maybe being a little bit naive, but you know, a former labor and employment lawyer. So I know there's still intentional bias and discrimination happening in the world, but a lot of what we have is not intentional. And I know we use the word implicit bias or unconscious bias, but we're talking like affinity bias, in-group bias. And so that is something that very much affects recruiting. And then we get you into the firm. And well, what are our processes for getting you feedback? What's our process for getting you work? Do we even have a process behind those things? Particularly in large law firms, usually the larger the practice group, the more likely it's to be this entrepreneurial, you know, meet people, get work, it'll be fine. And what we're finding is there's ways that we can systematize that we can track how busy someone is and what their interests are, and that we can have a partner reach out to perhaps either another partner or an actual resource manager to help staff their matters, which not only has a number of other implications for just efficiency and profitability, but it turns out that's really helpful for diversity and inclusion when you're not just relying on this sort of organic way to get things done. And I wanted to highlight those two, because those are examples of what I mean by systems. You know, there's things we can do as the organization. And I think I've also lost track of your question, because there's another aspect to it that I've already forgotten, but feel free to follow up.
I think that it was mostly, you know, what else could firms be doing to retain diverse talent?
You need as firms, and it's a little different with the in-house folks just because of how they're set up, but as firms, your diversity and inclusion and your talent departments should be working hand in hand. They should not be separate. Diversity cannot be in a silo. I frequently say a lot of the things that most impact diversity, they're not labeled diversity and inclusion. And so those teams really need to be, I mean, married. And I would say, depending on your org chart, that can change how easy or hard that is. Because I mean, it sounds mundane, but really just the way people are reporting can change to what extent they collaborate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. And I think in corporations, you're more likely to see diversity fall under HR. And there's obviously pros and cons to that, because in many ways, what I do is not, it's like not standard HR, and that, yes, it very much deals with people. But, you know, it's a little bit different than what people would typically think of as human resources. But I know in large law firms, sometimes diversity will sit completely outside of talent. Sometimes those departments will collaborate because they've kind of figured out that they need to. But also there's still places where it says diversity, it goes to Alexis, but Alexis will never have a comment on, you know, the state of our, you know, attorney review system. And I think that's a major missed opportunity to start moving things forward.
I think for, at least for us, one of the conversations I've wanted to have with these DEI podcasts is the human-centered side of things in DEI, being vaguely familiar with no parts of HR, as I'd like to keep it that way for the remainder of my career. But I think it's really interesting that when we talk technology, we have to talk this human side of DEI, because if they don't play together, anything that we're going to do next doesn't work. We can't have any sort of initiatives without taking that human aspect into parts of this. When we were talking prior to starting the recording for the podcast, Alexis, you mentioned the intersection of technology and diversity. Is that where we're sitting now, do you think? Or do you think we have a ways to go?
I think there's a lot of opportunities there, particularly in legal. So I think in large law firms, generally in terms of your data and information, you're optimized for client billing, and you are maybe not optimized, but you're also keeping things for government reporting. And putting those two systems together, putting HR and finance together, can be really powerful in terms of telling you about the people experience in your organization. And so that is something that we are in the process of doing at Bolli. I don't want to say too much because it's not set up yet. And I feel like that'll jinx it into taking longer than it should. But we've been doing a lot of work to figure out ways to marry those systems. In fact, talking to a great third party who it looks like will be able to help us do that, because there's information that I can glean very quickly with the right data, you know, analytical overlay beyond just the aggregate of how many of this group and that group, you know, wondering, you know, what's the experience in terms of work allocation? What are the, you know, average number of matters? What are the hours? Breaking things down by practice group, by department, by office, also to more quickly give people guidance. Because another thing that I've encountered, and I think many of us have seen this with diversity and inclusion, nobody's really, really figured it out. Like, it's really hard to point to someplace and be like, that's the roadmap. They did it. We're going to do what they did. Most of us are still figuring this out. And what I think is interesting about data, while I don't know that we want to be 100% data driven, we need to be data informed. And there's a lot more use we could get out of all this stuff we're creating, but just not using. But also what can happen with diversity and inclusion, and here's a really good example. Someone will say, all right, we need more women in the partnership. Okay, so how do we retain women? Let's figure out, we need a women's affinity group. We need a women's sponsorship program. We need resources focused on business development of women. And there's like, you can list all of these things. We need to help flex time attorneys. We need to help working mothers. You can list all these things that make sense as they would support women. But as we've been going through this process, learn more about our data, in particular, talking to this company called Pyracle, they gave a really interesting example of how data can help. And so they were working with a firm that was scratching their head, which is really having trouble getting women into the partnership. And when they looked at the data, what they found was it was because at this particular firm, they were diluting their partnership classes with their lateral hires. So it wasn't even that women were leaving this particular firm, which, by the way, this is just, I don't know what firm this was. This is not Foley I'm talking about. But it wasn't that women were leaving actually at higher rates than men. They were leaving at the same rate at this firm, but they were being replaced by men, because men are actually more likely to lateral. So for this firm, the fastest, like the most expedient thing they could do to increase the number of women in the partnership was actually to balance their lateral hiring. So it's not to say that that sponsorship program and that women's network and the other thing aren't, you know, won't be helpful and don't matter. They do. But truly, this was where their leak was happening in their progress. And by putting resources towards that, they were able to materially start changing the percentage of women and increasing promote to partnership. And that's what I mean by data informed. That's the type of thing that we can see, because there's just so many things going on. There's so many things you can do. And it's also hard because I realize a lot of organizations, you know, not everybody has a director of diversity and inclusion. Not everybody has dedicated talent staff or, you know, dedicated diversity resources. But for the places that are a bit more sophisticated and do have, you know, some funds and some resources at your disposal, this is, I think, the stuff that can help us start pinpointing where to point those resources so that we can start seeing some change.
I want to shift gears a little bit, because there's something I'm interested in asking you about, Alexis. And I'm not asking specifically about Foley, but you had mentioned, you know, your focus is on the legal side, on the attorney side of the equation. And I think across the board in legal as a whole, there isn't a whole lot of focus on the staff side, on diversity, equity, and inclusion for staff. So I'm just curious to get your insight as to, do you think that will ever change? Do you think what direction, you know, where firms might go with that in the future?
Yeah, it needs to change. And I mean, I'm here talking to you as a staff member, right? Mm-hmm. So I may be looking one direction, and yes, I have a JD, but at the end of the day, I'm on that side of the house. But I think a lot of the issues around that focus are, they're an outgrowth also of how law firms, the culture of law firms. And I think even separate from talking about diversity inclusion, someone who's been in a firm for a while, you know, depending on the firm, we're not all the same, will notice that dichotomy between lawyers and, as I would call, business services professionals, or as staff. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things that definitely fall under the umbrella of diversity and inclusion and belonging, but there's other culture shifts that we need to make as big law, as large law firms that don't just see the attorneys as, you know, the only truly valuable parts of the firm. And like, we get it, they're billing, they're the revenue generators, we understand. But I do think that you see in our industry more of that, well, sometimes called front of house, back of house, upstairs, downstairs, than you would say see in our colleagues at the consulting or accounting firms. I don't think you as much get that, like, but I'm the accountant you know, whereas somebody else who's perhaps in business development, you know, would be seen differently. So that's one of the big issues, I would say, that causes the business services professionals not to be as top of mind. I do think more and more firms are focusing on the inclusion there. I was actually just watched a panel put on by the Association of Law Firm Diversity Professionals, where a number of DEI professionals from large law firms talked about what they were doing to start to be more inclusive. But I do think one thing that is more difficult when you start looking more broadly at your entire organization, which, by the way, you should, but the difficulty is now we are bringing in a number of other roles and looking at, okay, well, what are the representation issues in IT versus in business development and marketing versus in our, you know, administrative staff? They're going to present different issues. And so I do think there also is just a matter of sort of, you know, bandwidth right now, just as the same thing with even the staffing focused on just the lawyers, but generally the lawyers are all sort of facing similar issues. So that's the other can of worms you open when you start really digging in with professional services staff.
Considering the bandwidth issues and the, you know, I'm sure budgetary concerns and things like that, and not having staffing to focus on that area, are there any things that you could recommend that firms do?
Yeah.
Just to like get the ball rolling.
Include people in things. So I see Karina's head nodding, but there's a lot of things that you will do for lawyers, you know, even if it's educational programming that you could easily include others in. I do know there's some other issues as well, particularly when we start talking about people who are, I mean, you know, exempt versus not exempt, hourly or salaried. You do sometimes run into a can of worms of, we don't want to make this person think they have to watch, and now, you know, we're making them stay for overtime. So I'm going to sidestep those. But setting that aside, there are ways that, and what you're seeing in large law firms is that, so being included in education and training and perhaps Cultural Heritage Month and historical celebrations, also that inclusion in affinity group, figuring out a model where, and you know, at Foley, we have some affinity groups that are open to professional services and some that are not, but and some firms are even doing separate ones. And those are sort of, I would say, the lower hanging fruit. But I do think there would also at some point be a place to really dig in to some of, you know, maybe these are the systemic issues. Why do we have this level of underrepresentation of X group within this sort of job function at our firm? I would say would be, you know, eventually what we're also trying to work towards.
There's a lot that we could continue to cover, and I'd love to, but unfortunately, I think we may just wrap up with one more question. And I think it's possibly the most important one we may have talked about this entire period, although I've just learned an incredible amount. Can we talk DEI self-care?
Yeah. I'm so glad you asked me, because that's why before we started, I was like, we need to talk about that too.
We do.
There's a couple of things around. There's a lot. So whether this be for a diversity inclusion professional listening or somebody who's on a diversity and inclusion committee, there's a number of issues with one, the subject matter you're dealing with, particularly when we're, you know, I know the racial justice movement, technically that the renewed one kicked off a little over a year ago, but for a lot of diversity and inclusion professionals, you were trying to serve an organization and you yourself were also traumatized. And you were also working hours that, you know, trying to be three people. And so I think there's this need to pause, take care of yourself in this. But the same thing goes for individuals who have other full-time jobs, but are leading that diversity and inclusion committee, whether it be in their organization or for an outside organization, and realizing that because, as you said, Bethann, this is human-centric work, every issue is important. There isn't a single issue you could bring me where I'd be like, but that's just not important. Because whatever you bring me, it deals with people. And what will always happen with DEI, it'll be like, great, it's great we're focused on gender and race and ethnicity, but what about first generation? What about the LGBTQ community? You know, what about people with disabilities? And I will never tell you that any group is less important than another. But unfortunately, as an organization, we do have to prioritize and say, absolutely, we hear you on that. You know, these are our three strategic priorities for this year. And so that's the other thing for DEI, whether you are doing this as a full-time job or, you know, some other committee capacity, you need to set some priorities. And I would say doggedly protect achieving those, because you will get inundated with other stuff. And I have seen so many, particularly committees, everybody has all of the energy and zeal, and then you keep calling each other and you have your meetings, but nothing actually gets done and more things keep getting added to the list. And so whether that be just so you can be efficient and get some stuff done, but also out of a sense of self-preservation, please, please, please do figure out a way to have some boundaries because you don't have a choice. And then recently I posted on LinkedIn about how I think a lot of diversity professionals, but anyone doing diversity work, you feel like Sisyphus, right? You're like trying to push this boulder up a hill and every day it falls back down. But it's also, I think, really important to remember that, at least for me, I'm advising on how to push the boulder up the hill. I'm not the one pushing it. I don't hire, fire, or promote in my organization. I advise. So what I need is to get a lot of other people to listen, particularly leadership, to do that pushing. And either way, it's still really hard work. But I think it's also important that people, I want your energy, I want your engagement, but don't think you have to do this alone because you will burn out.
I know, Bethann, you said that was the last question, but I have one more that I need to ask.
I'm always up for more questions. Go for it.
I have enjoyed this conversation so much with you, Alexis. I'm really interested to find out if there's any people, resources, books that you're reading, anything that has inspired you recently that you want to share with other people.
A little bit rapid fire. So Vernay Myers, who is now the VP of Inclusion at Netflix, she has some free learning resources on LinkedIn and she is amazing. She was a diversity and inclusion consultant before joining Netflix that many of us in the legal community and broader business community had the pleasure of working with. So anything by Vernay, I highly recommend. And then also just to confuse everyone a little bit, going from Vernay Myers to Brené Brown, I'm a huge fan of all things by Brené Brown. Back to what Bethann said about this being human-centric work, I think anything that allows you to better understand the human experience, and I'm even more of a fan of her book, Dare to Lead. She has another one coming out soon, but that book is where she translates so much of the work she's done to the workplace and is really powerful because we're talking diversity and inclusion, but this is also about leadership. You want to lead all people, not just a certain type. So almost anything by Brené Brown, I find tremendously helpful. And then the last but not least, because there's far more I could talk about, but Emotional Agility by Susan David, her work on helping people be self-aware and identify emotions and really align their values and their highest beliefs with their actions at the end of the day is ultimately what I'm trying to do as a diversity professional. And by the way, so Brené and Susan David are very similar in that vein, but I think the framework she provides is really helpful there. So while I said I'm a systems person, when I am doing those, changing hearts and minds, inclusion in the workplace and implicit bias, I often draw on the work of Susan David because it's really useful. So I tend to take things that aren't just D&I specific and make them relevant because I often say diversity and inclusion related work, this is life's work stuff. So I kind of can't expect you just to be inclusive in the workplace. I need you to be working on that everywhere else. And hopefully that also shows up in the workplace.
Well, I know I wasn't on mute buying something on Amazon. Don't worry. Well, that was an interesting way to end from my perspective, but I would like to take this opportunity to thank Foley for having both of you as employees. I am grateful for them, but I am more grateful to Karina for being my co-host and Alexis for joining us today. You both were wonderful. This conversation was both equitable and intelligent. I'm thanking you both again. And do you guys have anything last to say?
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I mentioned before, but please find me on LinkedIn. It can be a little bit random in terms of what I share, but I would say about 60% of it is diversity and inclusion related. So that's a great way to continue the conversation. And also I host a podcast for Foley and Lardner called The Path and the Practice. And each episode is me in conversation with a different Foley attorney, tracing their path to law. And also you can talk about their practice at Foley, but it's the stuff you wouldn't find on the bio. It's not labeled the Diversity and Inclusion Hour, but it very much shows the diverse backgrounds and perspectives of Foley attorneys, but also shows there's no prototypical path to law. And I think can just really help people see that, you know, if this is something you want to do, you can do it. So that those two places are great places to find me.
Well, thank you both very much. And Karina will speak soon.